Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Winds have reached 110 miles an hour in the Gulf of Mexico as Hurricane Harvey spins toward the Texas coast. Forecasters say Harvey will likely be a Category 3 storm by the time it makes landfall near Corpus Christi late today or early tomorrow morning. And the National Hurricane Center's David Zielinski says floods could be devastating.
Unfortunately, Harvey is expected to mostly stall over Texas right along the coast shortly after making landfall and stay there for several days. And because of that, some areas along coastal Texas could see rainfall totals of 30 inches or more through the middle of next week.
Let's bring in Jim Yarbrough, mayor of Galveston, Texas, a barrier island just south of Houston. Nothing between Galveston and the storm. So, Mayor Yarbrough, thank you for your time. I know you're busy. What do you want to say to the people in your area?
Well, just hunker down. It's going to be a little messy for 4 or 5 days because at least all the models and forecasts we see, Robin, that storm is going to come across down in the Port Aransas, Corpus, Matagorda Bay, but it's going to just turn east and north, just hover the coast. So we're going to have this stuff piled on top of us for more than normal.
Right. Well, but you say hunker down. Do you mean hunker down or get out?
Well, if you live on, what we've done is if you live on the west end of our island, which is beyond the seawall protection, we have asked for a voluntary evacuation starting yesterday, and we've had a number of people leave. If you live within the city behind the seawall, we're asking you to use your best judgment for you and your family, but we feel confident in the forecast and projections that if you hunker down in your house behind the seawall, you'll be fine.
Is that, when you say volunteer, is there a little bit of mandatory in there, too? Because we're hearing from other mayors, the mayor of Corpus Christi, who was asked, why not make it mandatory? And he said, well, we want people to make their own choice. But he even lost family, to...
Yes, I remember he lost family in San Marcos floods. Corpus is in a little different. If we were going to experience hurricane winds, and with those hurricane winds, the surge, the tide surge, and the wave action on top of the surge, we would probably be asking for a mandatory evacuation, certainly on the west end.
Yeah.
But we're 150, 60 miles up the coast from Corpus, where the main action is. We're confident that voluntary evacuation in our low-lying areas and our west end would be appropriate.
Yeah. Look, people know Galveston. They know the beautiful song, Glen Campbell.
Yeah.
Many know the terrible storm that killed up to 8,000 in 1900. So is there, an extra bit of, just a little bit of fear?
Yeah. I've been through a number of them myself. And, yes, every time you get a hurricane in the Gulf, whether it's this close or not, your heart skips a beat. They are not pleasant to deal with. There's always the possibility of loss of life, which is tough to handle because they're obviously your friends and neighbors. But this time of year we always kind of hold our breath till we get through the middle of September around here is when it starts kind of slowing down in the tropicals.
What about tourists? It's a big tourist area. You've got people who aren't familiar with this. I know some places are providing buses to bus people out. What do you do?
Obviously, we've been in communication with our surrounding networks of where our tourists normally come from, asking them to stay away.
Mm-hmm.
If they are here in town, I would suggest leaving town. Mm-hmm. But if not, stay in one of our hotels and hunker down with a lot of locals who have moved into hotels already.
How are you doing on supplies? We're seeing bare shelves. That's common.
Matter of fact, I just got a report from my wife this morning. She was at one of the stores, and shelves are stocked still. We still have gas at the gas station, so there's not been a panic, and that's what we try to preach around here, Robin, is be prepared, but don't panic. Panic doesn't get you anywhere. So right now we're in good shape. We're making our normal contacts with Red Cross and a lot of our support agencies, not so much during the event, but looking forward into the Tuesday-Wednesday frame where we may need some, quote, recovery services to help supplement things while we assess damage and get things back together down here.
And just remind me, been there many times, actually during storms, Isn't Galveston one of the areas where if you don't leave at a certain point, it's too late because of the roadways? I mean,
yes, and we'll be approaching that witch hour probably later on this afternoon, probably in that 5:30, 6 o'clock tonight, based on current forecast.
Well, then, Mayor, just one last question. It's hard for people to understand, then. Why not more mandatory evacuations? Just, you know, err on the side of caution.
Well, you know, we always try to do that, Robin. Again, every storm is unique. This one is, where are we going to send these people? Mm-hmm. It's going to rain more in Houston than here. It's going to rain more in Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, the normal destination places that our people would go to. And all those places from Galveston are a 4 or 5 hour trip. Mm-hmm. Sending them inland into unfamiliar territory where it's already going to be raining and they got more rivers and creeks up in that part of Texas than we have down here, it's just a tough call. So we think that we're on the right model. If you're on the low-lying areas, you need to get out of here. If you're in town, hunker down. We think we'll be able to deliver city services and keep afloat literally until Wednesday.
Jim Yarbrough, mayor of Galveston, Texas. Mayor Yarbrough, thanks and best to you.
Thanks, Robin. Appreciate it.
The violent clashes in Charlottesville have intensified the debate over whether cities should remove their Confederate statues. That's especially true in Alexandria, Virginia, home to one of the most celebrated Confederate memorials, the Appomattox statue. Patrick Madden from WAMU has our story.
For years, leaders in this left-leaning city have struggled over what to do with the Appomattox, the 7-foot bronze statue that sits in the middle of a busy intersection in Old Town. It depicts an unarmed Confederate soldier, arms folded and looking down. Impressions of what this statue means, who it represents, vary.
So I call this a totem pole of racism.
William F. Bailey grew up poor in Southern Virginia. When he was young, he says he picked tobacco in fields where he was called racist names by white supervisors. Bigotry was out in the open.
And I hear people talk about, you know, seeing things on TV. I saw Klan meetings. I saw the Klan in their hoods. I saw them burning crosses, and I was just told not to look that away. When we talk about these statues and renaming streets, I'm for it 100%.
It's been a remarkable personal journey for Bailey. He moved to Alexandria and later joined the fire department, and in 2015, he was elected to the Alexandria City Council. Last year, the council voted to relocate the statue, which is owned by a Southern Heritage group, to a nearby museum. But that move can't happen until the Republican-led state legislature in Richmond signs off, which no one expects anytime soon. But Bailey and others say they will continue to press lawmakers to remove the Appomattox statue.
This is someone that wanted slavery to continue.
To Bailey, these Confederate memorials are painful symbols of Virginia's racist past. But others see them as a way to celebrate their Southern heritage and view campaigns to remove the statues as an attack on their ancestors.
This is an across-the-board campaign to wipe out anything having to do with the Confederacy.
Jared Taylor is the founder of American Renaissance, a white nationalist group based in Fairfax. As the campaign to remove Confederate statues has gained traction across the South, white nationalist groups have emerged as the most vocal opponents.
To somehow decide that these are people, all wicked villains of history because the Confederacy was based on slavery, then that means George Washington, that means Andrew Jackson, that means 9 of the first 11 presidents of the United States were all villains. Are we going to write them out of history?
Taylor may represent a group with extreme views, but his comments on Confederate statues are not out of step with many in America, including President Trump, who has echoed Taylor's sentiments. A recent NPR poll found more than 60% of registered U.S. voters believe the statues shouldn't be removed. And in Virginia, fighting to preserve Confederate symbols can also resonate politically. This summer, Corey Stewart, the chairman of the Board of Supervisors in Prince William County, nearly pulled off an upset over Ed Gillespie in the Republican primary for governor. Stewart put the Confederate statue issue front and center in his campaign. Here's what he said during his election night concession speech.
We will not rest until we defend our history and heritage and stop this politically correct insanity that is coming across this country.
Many communities in Northern Virginia are seeped in Civil War history. But the area's demographics are also changing. There's been a flood of newcomers, many of whom are uneasy with the Confederate symbols that dot the landscape. Justin Wilson, the vice mayor of Alexandria, says a few years back, the city formed a task force to take stock of all the schools and streets named after Confederate leaders.
There's a lot of stuff, things that you didn't even know and didn't realize. Burgard Street, Matthew Morey Elementary School, Pickett Street, you know, Forest Street.
The group found more than 30 streets named after Confederate figures. A city law passed in 1963 required that every new street in Alexandria running north and south be named after a Confederate leader. That law wasn't revoked until 2 years ago. Now, after Charlottesville, Wilson says there's a feeling that it's time to rethink this area's Confederate roots.
This has become a cause that people feel like they can take on and make a difference.
These statues, like the Appomattox in Old Town, were put up to remember the Confederacy. But for a growing number of vocal opponents, it's time to move on.
So how did the week look on social media? President Trump retweeted an image of himself slowly passing over, then blocking an image of President Obama with the caption, "Best eclipse ever." Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and his wife watched the eclipse from Fort Knox, something that came to light after his designer-draped wife said on Instagram that they both were sacrificing for their country. On Friday, we look at the news through social media. Let's do that now with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
So the president's fans loved the eclipse tweet, but what else did you see in response?
Well, if you give me one meme on Twitter, you know there will be tweets who will better it. Mm. So this is what Tricia Coachman did. She took the same four boxes, but this time in the background was President Trump and eclipsing him was President Barack Obama. And then this one, says Tricia, was out way before that copycat one you posted. ... sad dude. One more from HRH Alex II, and he has Robert Mueller, the investigator, eclipsing Trump, and his one-line headline, "Justice!" exclamation mark.
Look, on CNN, they showed how people were making these eclipse memes with their puppies. One woman had a black puppy and a white puppy, and she had the black puppy, the moon, you know, eclipsing the white, holding them up, eclipsing each other. But others noted that the president might not have remembered, you know, in the eclipse meme that he retweeted in the four boxes as he passes President Obama and then blocks him, the moon, the blocker, does move on. The sun, the blockee, ends up shining.
Indeed. Yeah. That is the basic science of how an eclipse works.
And well, the tweet was posted by a man named Jerry Travone. It's been retweeted thousands of times. But he's also posted things like, "We have enough of these Jews where I live. Someone else take them. They can't drive." So this is also a cautionary tale we continue to see with the president.
It doesn't take much research either, because you look up Jerry Travone and his Twitter profile says, "YouTube actor, political junkie, proud Trump supporter and pushback against liberalism." And he's had a lot of fans and also a lot of critiques after sharing this best eclipse ever meme. And he says, "You'll see my tweets from the past and take it however you want, but I don't back down." Which is probably why the President Trump retweeted him in the first place.
Right, but maybe somebody should look at some other postings that he's had, or maybe they don't care. Look, another big social media story is about the eclipse, but it began as something else. This is the story of Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's wife, Louise Linton. She posted an image on Instagram showing her and Mnuchin stepping off a government plane. She included hashtags for all the luxury brands she was wearing, hashtag Hermes scarf, hashtag
nice.
Tom Ford sunnies. Jennifer Miller of Oregon commented that it was deplorable. The Secretary of Treasury's wife said what?
She said there's a very long response to Jenny Miller. And she started off with cute and then a little kissy emoji. "Aw, did you think this was a personal trip? Adorable." And then she talks about how she and her husband pay more taxes. Final line, this is a killer. "Go chill out and watch the new Game of Thrones. It's fab. Cersei would be proud of her."
Well,
Cersei's a character from Game of Thrones, if
right.
you don't watch it, by the way.
She also said, "Either as an individual earner in taxes or in self-sacrifice to your country, do you think you've given more than me and my husband?" Well, Linton apologized, but speaking of sacrifice, it turns out the trip they were on was to Fort Knox in Kentucky. There's another Instagram picture showing Mnuchin and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell clutching their eclipse glasses.
What a coincidence. Isn't that amazing? It's extraordinary.
Well, and now a watchdog group is questioning, this is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Was that government trip just to go see the eclipse.
Now, the Treasury Secretary is now paying back the travel expenses of his wife, Louise Linton, for going on that trip.
$10,000 an hour, I believe, for
Very expensive travel there.
Yeah.
And the Citizens for Ethics say, the funny thing is, if she never went on her Instagram rant, we would never have noticed the trip.
Yeah.
Louise Linton's Instagram account and Twitter account are now both private.
Well, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, Oregon, is also asking for an explanation of the trip. Of course, Mnuchin is saying, and others are saying, that he was there to see Fort Knox. There's something
the
to
gold at Fort Knox.
Yeah, the gold at Fort Knox. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so there's something there that's... Anyway.
Yes. But it's a good lesson in humble bragging. More humble, less bragging. And also knowing your audience on Instagram, knowing if they really would like you to share your wardrobe with them or whether they would rather not have that as part of their Instagram feed. So a couple of good social lessons right there.
I just want to touch base with you on the neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer. They'd been shut down, but then they were back on the web under a new domain name, not for long though, and seemed to be shut back down, back into the deep web, only accessible with certain
the dark
software.
Web.
Yeah, dark web. Yeah. Talk about, you know, this whack-a-mole that hosting companies are having to go through.
So it's not so much shutting down, Robin. It's more like you have your website, but if you don't have a platform, a host to put it out there, no one sees it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Daily Stormer wants maximum number of people to see their message, which is a neo-Nazi and white supremacist message. Shortly after Charlottesville, the original web hoster, GoDaddy, said, "We're not hosting you anymore." They went to another hoster. They said, "We're not hosting you anymore." They found another one just 24 hours ago by changing their domain name. So they changed their name to punishedstormer.com. I looked at it yesterday. It was there. I looked at it this morning and it wasn't. And that was because that current web hoster got some feedback, some pushback from their other users saying, we don't want you to host this website. And then they were pushed off.
So the whack-a-mole continues.
Again.
Yep.
Indeed.
Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you as always.
You're so welcome.
Lawmakers in several states are considering an eco-friendly option for disposing of human remains. It's called flameless or water cremation. It involves dissolving bodies in a chemical bath. A bill to allow the process is now making its way through the California legislature. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED in San Francisco explains what it's all about.
You may not equate death with climate change, but disposing of dead bodies actually leaves a fairly hefty carbon footprint.
Cremation is really what people hold up as the environmentally friendly option.
Caitlin Dowdy is a mortician in Los Angeles.
It's better than the whole rigmarole of formaldehyde and chemicals and big caskets, but it releases mercury into the air. It uses a whole ton of natural gas.
That's why a green alternative is attracting attention. The Green Burial Council reports the carbon footprint of water cremation is just a quarter of traditional cremation and a sixth of burial, which takes up land and involves bringing materials for concrete headstones, mahogany caskets, and a slew of embalming chemicals from all over the world. There's only one place where it's happening in California legally, a Chile lab at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Okay. This is where we load the body on over here, and a loader.
Dean Fisher is the head of UCLA's donated body program, meaning he's in charge of cadavers the medical school no longer needs. Bodies are brought to a room that smells a little like shellfish.
It's a smell that comes with the potassium hydroxide.
That's the chemical combined with hot water to liquefy bodies. It's a strong base on the pH scale. That's why the process is technically called alkaline hydrolysis.
So it's not an acid at all. Some people say this is an acid bath, and they're wrong.
Potassium hydroxide, a chemical found in dirt and in many household cleaning products, speeds up decomposition.
Crust. So like if you were to bury a body in soil, all we're doing is we're speeding that up. We're adding heat to that.
The heat happens inside a shiny stainless steel chamber that's about the size of a large van. Fisher swings open a circular hatch modeled after a submarine door. It leads to a dark tunnel. He slides a cadaver inside. Inside. 270 gallons of water begins to fill the machine.
So like right now we're at 114 degrees already as we're heating up to 302.
Is it kind of like, I mean, what I'm thinking of is like a whirlpool or a hot tub or a washing machine. Is there something it's like?
And you forgot dishwasher. Since we're sterilizing here, everything that comes out can be touched, and it is sterile. The bone is sterile.
And the fluid that will eventually swirl down the drain will also be sterile. No bacteria, not even a strand of DNA survives. And the process takes about 3 to 4 hours, which is about twice as long as a traditional cremation. All that's left when Fisher pulls the door open is a tray scattered with clean white bones. These will be pulverized into a powder that can be preserved in an urn, just like ashes. There's also some hardware from the man's former life.
There's a pacemaker in there. There's a couple prosthetics. It looks like he's had a hip replacement and probably a knee replacement also.
Some of these parts can be recycled. From a cupboard nearby, Fisher shows me a tooth with a mercury filling. This demonstrates part of why water is greener than flame. When you burn a body, mercury dental fillings vaporize and escape into the air. But to some, dissolving bodies is a tough sell.
This just sort of leaves us questioning, why did part of Grandma go to the waste treatment plant?
Ned DeLessi is a spokesman for the Catholic Church in California. He says water cremation doesn't treat life, or really death, with dignity and respect.
But it's like, really? That's what we're doing?
The Catholic Church is the only formal opposition to California's bill to allow water cremation. The first two times similar legislation was proposed, the Funeral Directors Association was also against it. But they're now on board because they say the UCLA lab has proved disposal is safe. And other states are also getting over the ick factor. Water cremation is now legal in 14 states. And there are active bills not only in California, but also in Indiana and Washington. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods Market finalizes Monday, now that the Federal Trade Commission has approved the $13.7 billion deal. Starting Monday, Amazon Prime members will get discounts on some items at Whole Foods, and shoppers will be able to buy some Whole Foods products on Amazon.com. Yesterday, the stock prices of several supermarket chains tumbled at the news. Why that happened and what all of this means? We're joined by Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, to tell us. So, Mike, this is pretty big news in the industry, the Amazon acquisition of Whole Foods. The surprise is that it's happening really fast because the announcement from Amazon that it was interested in acquiring Whole Foods came in June. The FTC did not have problems with it, apparently. A lot of people thought they would. What happened?
Oh, right. There was a review by the FTC, but it was a very quick one that was finished within a 30-day window that's really designed for very simple mergers. And regulators are often hands-off with deals like these because the two companies don't compete with each other directly. But that said, Amazon's dominance in online retail had really complicated the picture somewhat in a lot of people's minds. So there was a lot of criticism from public interest groups, and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union was an aggressive opponent of the deal because they were worried that the merger would lead to more automation of grocery jobs that would really threaten workers. But ultimately, none of it was enough to convince the FTC to do a more thorough review of the deal.
So Amazon says it's announcing lowering prices. That is on Monday, but you have to be a Prime member to get discounts. Does that mean that for the rest of us, everything's going to be more expensive?
Well, come Monday, there will be discounts available for anyone shopping at Whole Foods for certain grocery items. But you're right. The plan is to integrate the two companies' technologies so that Prime members will be recognized at the cash register, and then Prime members will actually receive additional discounts going forward. It's estimated that nearly two-thirds of Whole Foods' regular customers are already Prime members, so there's a good deal of overlap already.
So in a way, Amazon is really, this is kind of a war call for Amazon against all its competitors. Who are the main competitors, and who stands to be hurt most by this?
Well, the stock market reaction was, as you mentioned, was really brutal for the big grocery chains like Kroger and even the Walmart, the stock of Walmart.
That's kind of interesting.
Target.
Walmart sells so many more things than groceries.
Right, right. But, you know, the market is really reacting strongly to this as a threat. And I think to some degree, the stock market's looking even further down the line and seeing these Whole Foods supermarkets as also sort of a depot for all of Amazon products. They've already announced that you'll be able to have items shipped to Whole Foods and use the store as a place to return items to Amazon if you need to return. So the market, you know, is sort of looking forward to all the possibilities that this deal could open up.
Okay. And really briefly, what does this do overall to the industry?
I think it really, you know, it gives the grocery industry a very stiff competitor. I mean, the grocery business is all about the supply chain, getting the right products on the shelves in the right amounts. And, you know, that's different from store to store across the country. So Amazon really brings this technology expertise to that process.
Good to talk to you. Michael Regan, Senior Editor, Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
So would you get a $300 microchip implanted in your hand if your employer offered one for free? That was the offer Wisconsin technology company 3Square Market made to its workers, a chip the size of a grain of rice implanted in your hand. It functions like an ID. You can swipe into the office or pay for food in the cafeteria with a wave of the hand. Critics aren't hard to find. It sounds like another step towards 1984-style corporate America. But already at least 50 of 3Square Market's 80 employees have signed up. They had that chip party you may have heard about earlier this month where they all got their implants. So how's it going? Well, joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota, Todd Westby, CEO of 3Square Market and one of the company's employees who decided to get the chip, also the guy who came up with the idea, Tony Dana, Director of International Sales. Tony, I want to start with you. Can you feel it?
I mean, I can feel it if I put my hand up to it. That's the only way I notice it.
It's between the thumb and finger?
Yeah, the thumb and the forefinger right in there.
Well, Todd, again, the CEO, Tony's boss, what was your thinking behind doing this?
Well, being a technology company, when Tony first brought the idea up to me, it really wasn't that far-fetched. And we initially looked at this as this would be fun and neat internally because we develop stuff. It's since then turned into a heck of a lot more.
Meaning what?
Well, it's all the attention it's gathered. You just can't believe some of the people that have contacted us as far as wanting it. The military, foreign countries, our embassies. We brought this subject basically to the forefront by doing it, but we never had intentions of doing that.
Well, so your employees have become like walking billboards for your microchipping company. By the way, the slogan that we know your company uses is micro market solutions for vending machines. So that's part of this, right? You just wave your hand in front of a vending machine and it treats it like a credit card?
Any door card reader, any credit card reader, any convenience store reader, you just basically set your hand within a couple inches of it and it'll accept the form of payment or whatever you're, you know, requesting it to do.
And Tony, you work with microchips, but what is that like when you're just kind of waving your hand and does it ever happen accidentally? You know, you walk by the vending machine and you've bought, you know, three sodas.
that's a question that we've got a lot, but no, it hasn't happened. And, you know, you've got to be within 6 inches of that reader for it to even pick up the frequency there. So it's not something that I've experienced, nor do I worry about, because you've got to have the hand right up next to the reader.
But was it exciting? Is it?
It was a blast. You know, from the time you get chipped to when you sit down with our software developers and they write the code for you that allows you access into the doors, and then next thing you know, you get your computer. Now you're logging into your computer using your hand. And then we've got our break room market. Now I'm finalizing my purchases in the break room market. So it's all those things that you never thought that were inconvenient, and that's now just a part of you, and it makes your life more convenient.
Well, this kind of thinking has been around. You can open a locked car with a thumbprint, you know, and your phone as well with your thumbprint. But this is something that's been implanted in you. And you know, Todd, back to you again, the CEO of 3Square Market, people are freaked out about this. Maybe some of your own employees. This idea that what else can they do with this? What else can you do with it? Can you track employees? Can you see where they've been or where they're going?
Tracking really has nothing to do at all with this particular chip. However, there are GPS chips available, like what the military uses. But this chip is just for basically opening doors, playing music, unlocking your phone. It's really narrowly defined, and you have to have system keys to basically access the power of the chip.
But can that be changed down the road once you have the chip in? Can you redesign the technology from outside and make it a GPS tracker?
Yes, and that's actually in the plans for 2018, even though this has been around for about a month with us. But we've had a lot of requests from parents who literally want to chip their children.
Oh, but see, that's what's frightening people. You say it can be, converted into that. And I don't know if kids are going to be taking that idea to court, don't track me. But what about the ethical questions of creating a technology for an employer to be able to track an employee?
This chip, particular chip that we're using, cannot be used as a GPS tracker. You have to get a totally different chip that is basically battery powered. And we're looking at using the human body as the battery to power that chip.
Wow. So obviously there's interest in this.
Well, I mean, today's world, we were contacted by the law enforcement. They asked if we could put geo-reference rings around sex offenders' homes so that if a child had a chip in them and they were missing, or if it went off or set an alarm, basically they would be inside of a ring where they're not supposed to be.
Wow. And you going to do that?
You know, it's something, believe it or not, the interest in that is a lot greater than you think. We had a foreign country contact us without naming the particular country right now, but they have a lot of kidnappings with orphans. And they basically said, can we do something to put a chip in a child so that if he's taken out of the village, we'd know where they are?
What about the health concerns? This is a foreign object in someone's skin, electronic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a biocompatible glass, so all of the RFID technology within that glass is completely protected. There was when I was over in Sweden, one of the guys that I was talking to had actually got into a car accident going 80 miles per hour, and he had the implant in his hand, and it had only moved 1 inch within his hand, so that it wasn't like it busted open or anything like that. So,
1 inch or 1 centimeter?
1 centimeter is probably more yeah. Like it.
Yeah.
So I don't really have any concerns. I mean, when you see the microchip and you're holding it in your hand, it's a pretty secure deal that it's not much to worry about, in my opinion.
We'll have a picture at herenow.org. But Tony, do you worry about hacking? It's obvious that this is technology that's only going to advance and do other things. What about people stealing information out of that chip?
One thing that's really nice about our company is we are a technology company, so working directly with the software team. And when they're putting together their plan on how we're developing our applications, it's layer upon layer upon layer, which makes it much, much harder to be hacked. I mean, you cannot say anything out there cannot be hacked, but the way that they're doing it in a very responsible manner is making sure that our applications are protected.
And keep in mind, one thing regarding the chip is the chip only has about 100 characters of memory on it, meaning what's used on the chip mainly is the serial number, which ties you to the ability to open a door or log in a computer. So there's really not information on the chip. And the chip itself is encrypted with 256-bit encryption. So if you were to read it, you wouldn't be able to do anything with it.
Look, I'm thinking of the other things that you're talking about doing with these chips, chipping children. And, people chip their dogs already. So if they're lost, there's a reader that can scan their body and see the chip information. So that's already happening. But Tony, Todd, either of you take it. What do you worry about? You must worry about something.
It breaking in my hand, that's about it.
Tony?
I think that's about the only thing that's crossed my mind as well, is breaking in my hand and...
By the way, what would happen?
You'd basically have to get it taken out. It'd be like a piece of glass or something in there. Just to check this theory out, my son, who's a football player, has a chip in his hand, and we'll see how it works through the football season.
Employees and son as guinea pigs. That's Todd Westby, CEO of Three Square Market, a Wisconsin-based tech company. They make chips. and they recently offered their employees microchip implants. A lot took them up on it. By the way, Todd, the ones that didn't, what'd they say to you?
Just no thanks. I don't care to have it, and that's just fine.
Yeah. And Tony Dana, it was his idea. He's director of international sales, and they've gotten a lot of attention from people like us talking to them about it. Todd, Tony, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
In a part of northern India today, mobs smashed cars, attacked media vans, and set fire to two train stations. The rampage began after a court declared the popular 50-year-old leader of a quasi-religious sect guilty of raping two of his followers. The BBC's Sanjoy Majundar is in Delhi. And Sanjoy, this man is described as a guru. Who is he?
His name is Gurmeet Ram Rahim Singh. He's often known as a rock star guru or the guru of bling. And that's mainly because he's a really flamboyant figure. He doesn't belong to organized religion. He works outside of organized religion. He's a spiritual leader. And if you see him, he's often seen on the back of a motorcycle wearing very colorful clothes with a lot of really bling jewelry. And his public appearances when he meets his followers have resembled something of a rock concert. He's put out music videos. He's acted in films that he's scripted and directed as well. And he has a massive following. It's difficult to get an accurate figure of the number of followers he has. By his own account, it's well over several million across India as well as countries around the world. But he does have very, very passionate followings, drawn mainly from very poor backgrounds, communities who feel that, they are excluded from organized religion, and also a lot of female followers.
He also has, we should say, his organization, which proselytizes about vegetarianism and against drug addiction. He helps organize weddings for impoverished couples. This is perhaps one of the reasons he has such a following among the poor.
Yes, that's right. He has a huge cult-like following. As I said, often communities or people who feel that, they don't get enough attention from organized religions tend to gravitate towards spiritual leaders like Gurmeet Ram Rahim Singh. And he also does carry out those reform programs you talked about. He's worked a lot with alcohol addicts, for instance. And that really is where he derives his power from the fact that he has so many followers. When he was brought to court earlier today, he arrived in a convoy of about 100 vehicles, all of them carrying his followers. It was very much a statement of intent, a show of strength, really, to demonstrate the kind of power he has and in some ways to perhaps intimidate the authorities, before they convicted him.
Well, he was indeed convicted. What was he found guilty of?
He was found guilty of raping two female followers who were members of his sect. This is a case that dates back 15 years. It started when an anonymous letter was written to the then Indian Prime Minister, where he was accused of raping several women who were part of his sect. It took the federal police 5 years to gather enough evidence to press charges, and it's taken this long to actually convict him for these crimes.
Sanjoy, is there any doubt about the merits of the accusations against him, especially because it took so long for the evidence to be gathered?
I think the reason it took long is quite simply because it was so difficult to convince people to come forward. He is a very powerful person, not just because he is a spiritual leader, but because he does have very close contacts with politicians who often, rely on the fact that he's so popular. They depend on his support as well during times of need, such as fighting elections. The fact is, it took a lot of convincing for the women who he's alleged to have who he's been convicted of raping to actually come forward and testify before a court of law. So there's very little doubt, really, that he is guilty of what he's been accused of. I should say that one of the first journalists to report on these accusations was mysteriously shot dead soon after those accusations were made public.
So authorities had anticipated that if he had been found guilty, which he has been, that there would be some violence. They apparently ordered internet and cell phone service to be shut down. Schools were closed, and more than 15,000 paramilitary troops and police officers were eventually deployed. Why, even with his popularity, has there been so much violence as a result of the conviction?
I think despite the fact that there was all those measures you mentioned, you know, heavy security in place, internet services suspended and so on, the biggest criticism has been that they should never have allowed his supporters to gather in the first place. I think the fact that something like 200,000 of his supporters were able to gather over several days close to the courtroom and in the town where the trial was taking place and where the hearing took place made it very difficult then for the authorities to bring down any semblance of order once the conviction was made public, because his supporters simply took to the streets. They attacked police lines. They threw stones at them. They set vehicles and public buildings on fire. The police initially used water cannons and tear gas canisters to try and, you know, gain control over the streets. And once that failed, they started opening live ammunition rounds. And that's when a lot of the casualties took place.
That's the BBC's Sanjay Majumdar in Delhi, where a wildly popular sect leader has been found guilty of rape, and the response among his followers has been a violent one. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Jeremy Hobson's back on Monday. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. Good luck, Texas. This is Here and Now.